You know, I sat through meetings where researchers and doctors would talk about CBD, mind you, not THC. We were always dealing with just CBD. And they would joke about getting high, or they would joke about, you know, stoners. And it was belittling and it was offensive because I was talking to them about treating my son's life-threatening condition. Right. And they were joking to me about getting high.
This is the Cannabis Enigma, cutting through the smoke to have informed, serious conversations for regular people. I'm Michael Schaefer Omerman.
And I'm Alana Goldberg.
Hey, Alana.
How you doing, Mike?
Well, still stuck at home. It's been about 3 weeks now.
Yep. You're recording from your wardrobe again?
Yep. Still the Conigma Studios in my bedroom closet.
Yep.
I can't help but think back on a couple months ago when we recorded this interview. It was a very different world.
Yeah, it was indeed. So it was just under 2 months ago. We were in Portugal, in Lisbon, for the CANEX Medical Cannabis Conference. And I guess at that point, you know, news of the coronavirus was just starting to filter out and people were just starting to take it seriously. Things look very different now.
Right. There's a lot of uncertainty, instability, scariness out in the world. And while we're doing quite a bit of talking about that, we thought that we'd bring you a different kind of story today.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this story, it's an interview with a VP from Tilray called Catherine Jacobson. And it's an interesting story because it's a combination of her personal story and her professional story. She has a son who suffers from a rare type of epilepsy. And when he was treatment resistant, she decided to go about getting him the medication that he needed by herself, which of course was cannabis. But in this situation, she actually ended up making the medication for him in a lab in her garage.
Right. At some point she says, you know, I just happened to have a PhD in neuroscience.
Yeah. Really amazing. I think, you know, what makes this story relevant today, regardless of what's going on around us, is that it's really a story of a mother doing anything to help her child. I think that's what's really compelling here.
Absolutely. And then setting out her professional life to ensure that others didn't find themselves in the same situation.
Yeah, really. I found it really inspiring doing this interview. And I got to tell you, Mike, it wasn't an easy interview. There were some really emotional parts there for Catherine and also for me, as you know, also as a parent listening to this interview. It's heavy stuff.
Right. So let's listen to the interview. And please, if you're enjoying this podcast, subscribe, like, rate, review us wherever you listen to your podcasts. And thanks for listening.
Catherine, thanks for joining me here today. Like so many people in the industry, I know that your kind of journey with medical cannabis started off from your personal story. Can you tell us a bit about that to begin with?
Yes. So our second child, Ben, started having seizures when he was 14 weeks old, and we knew nothing about epilepsy. We were told that he has a high likelihood of just growing out of it or being controlled on medication. Mm-hmm. He was one of the very, very unlucky infants with epilepsy that is not controlled on medication.
Mm-hmm. What type of epilepsy does he have?
So he was born with a brain malformation called polymicrogyria.
Okay.
And it affects a small part of his brain, but often leads to very severe treatment-resistant epilepsy. Mm-hmm. The mutation that caused the polymicrogyria is unknown. Mm-hmm. So we can't really say why he got that.
Right. Okay. And when did you first consider medical cannabis as a treatment for Ben?
So let's see. He was about 3 years old in 2012. Wow. When, you know, after 3 years of trying all of the available treatments, I decided to go back to train in epilepsy research at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And I had happened to have my PhD in neuroscience before Ben was born, so quite a coincidence. And it was during that year when I was at Stanford that I began hearing stories of from families with children with severe epilepsy, mm-hmm. and that they were treating their kids with cannabis, and they were reporting good outcomes. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I was interested. They were giving their kids, like some of them were crushing up the cannabis and putting it in capsules.
Okay.
Some of them were making butters with cannabis, right. and giving a teaspoon a day or a teaspoon twice a day. Some were making suppositories. Mm-hmm. So it was all over the map. Some were trying to extract. And everyone was doing something slightly different. Nobody knew exactly what was in the cannabis they were giving the right. children, right? They were just trying to do the best they could.
When was this? I'm trying to...
This was in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so at the same time that I heard these stories, I went to PubMed, mm-hmm. and I found articles on the anticonvulsant activity of both CBD and THC. Mm-hmm. So both can be anticonvulsive. Now, if you look at the data closely, you see that THC can be proconvulsive in some cases.
Really?
So, whereas CBD isn't. Mm-hmm. These are in preclinical animal models. Mm-hmm. And clinical trials had been done in the 70s and 80s on adults with a particular type of epilepsy, temporal lobe epilepsy. Mm-hmm. So I took all of that information and I decided for us, and again, I want to stress that this was just the decision I made for us,
sure.
that CBD in doses of hundreds of milligrams mm-hmm. was the safest thing for us to try. So now, years later, after we've done trials and such, Ben is on a dose of 450 milligrams per day.
Wow, okay.
That's a pretty high dose.
Mm-hmm. And how did you make a decision about the dose to begin with?
So I looked at the papers, mm-hmm. and the adults were given in one study 200 milligrams per day, in the other study 300 milligrams. Mm-hmm. But I also emailed Rafi Machulam because he was an author on these studies.
Right.
And I said, look, here's my situation. What would you recommend based on your experience?
Right.
And he agreed that, you know, 200 to 300 milligrams was a good place to start.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I've seen some data recently showing that actually children generally have higher dosage than adults with CBD and also with THC products. Has that been your experience?
Well, it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't know of any adults who are treating epilepsy with CBD. So it depends on which symptom you're right. trying to treat. And I really don't think we have a lot of data to show how much CBD to use for anything other than epilepsy. Mm. It's kind of a trial and error approach.
Okay, right? And certainly not at that point when you were considering it.
That's
There's
right.
There's more data now. So you made this decision about what dosage you were going to try and what formulation. What happened after that?
So I went to the dispensary in San Francisco and I said, can I have some CBD, please? Because I thought that's what they did.
Right.
Of course they didn't. They handed me dried flower mm-hmm. and said, here's CBD. And I looked at him and I said, what do you mean here's CBD? You're handing me flower, which I know contains 100 different compounds, mm-hmm. right? And I think what he was trying to say is here's some dried flower that has a higher CBD content than any other dried flower in the store.
Mm-hmm.
So I set out to make it myself then. And what I had to find first was dried flower that had enough CBD in it to make it worth my while to extract it, mm-hmm. but also it had to be low in THC.
Right.
Because the method I used to separate the THC from the CBD mm-hmm. depended on that initial ratio. So I was lucky because I found a chemist at UC Davis mm-hmm. who actually had started a cannabis testing lab. And with his help, I learned how to extract the cannabinoids with ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
I used column chromatography to separate fractions of the cannabinoids.
Can you explain what that is?
So column chromatography, so THC and CBD move through these columns of carbon. They're mm-hmm. pure carbon, C14.
Mm-hmm.
So you have imagine a test tube that has this white powder in it. The white powder is carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And you use a vacuum filtration to pull the extract, mm-hmm. the ethanol, the cannabinoids in the ethanol, through the carbon column.
Mm-hmm.
THC and CBD move through that column at different rates because of their chemical properties.
Right.
So I collected fractions of 10 mLs from that column. Mm-hmm. And then with Don's help, the chemist, I could analyze the fractions and find out which fractions had CBD but no THC. Right. So then I could take those fractions, combine them, evaporate the ethanol, and I had then an extract that was concentrated for CBD. It still contained other components of the cannabis plant, and I never really looked at what those other components were. Mm-hmm. I focused on the fact that there was THC. I wanted to know how much THC, which he could tell me, mm-hmm. and what the concentration of CBD was. Mm-hmm. And so then I could calculate, and I used the pipette because it was ethanol, mm-hmm. right, it was alcohol, and I didn't want Ben to get a lot of alcohol. Mm-hmm. So I used the pipetter to get the right volume that would give me 200 milligrams of CBD mm-hmm. or 300 milligrams. And often it was a fraction of a milliliter because it was so highly concentrated.
Wow. You know, I'm listening to you kind of talk through this process, and I'm struck by, first of all, how lucky Ben is that he happened to get you as a mother. And secondly, how inaccessible, you know, a course of action like this would be to pursue treatment for, I mean, the majority of other parents in a similar situation.
Yeah. And I have to say, it was actually awful. I mean, I spent, first of all, it was expensive.
Yeah.
And I was buying pounds of marijuana from drug dealers all over California. Mm-hmm. So I had to find them. And then I had to go to their houses and buy it for thousands of dollars per pound, right? And it was so anxiety producing. So once I figured out that it actually benefited Ben, every batch was different because the starting material was different. And I didn't have any consistency in how I did it. Imagine this setup in my garage, you know, no standard procedure defined.
Yeah.
And there were days where I would work on this for a week and at the end not get the right outcome and then have nothing to give him. So it was absolutely, it was just an incredible amount of stress, right, to be responsible for making Ben's medication mm-hmm. on top of dealing with the daily management of uncontrolled epilepsy. And it was too much for me. Mm-hmm. It was too much. And that's why, so the full story is that I had a friend who had a son with epilepsy, mm-hmm. a different type of epilepsy than Ben. So Ben responded with maybe a 40% seizure reduction.
Okay.
This other child responded with an almost complete seizure reduction. And so then it became even more stressful to make it, right? Because now I had two kids depending on me. So at the end of all of this, and after many failed attempts when they didn't get their CBD, this other mother and I decided to approach GW Pharma because I just could not do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And there was no other source out there. There was no company I could go to besides GW that was capable of making it at the time.
Okay. And what was GW able to help you with?
GW was wonderful. So they agreed. Well, first they needed to, so they were aware of the data showing that there's anticonvulsant activity with CBD and mm-hmm. THC. They were also aware of all the stories. So by now, imagine this is now a year and a half later. They had heard all the stories from the parents. But it was always unclear what the best product would be. Mm-hmm. Was it some combination of CBD and THC, or was it CBD alone? And if it was CBD alone, what was the right dose? Mm-hmm. So they got all of that information from our experiments, basically, mm-hmm. right? So they were willing to do this, even though what we asked them for was, can you make a pharmaceutical preparation of CBD? And would you be willing to supply it if we got the FDA to agree to give it to our kids through compassionate access. Mm-hmm. And so they tested my preparation. The other child actually flew to London to be given their preparation for 2 weeks in London so they could observe the effects. Mm-hmm. And after all of that due diligence on their part, they were willing to do it. And it was still a big risk to them because it's a cannabinoid. Even though it's not psychoactive, there was a lot of talk about giving medically fragile children this Schedule I substance, mm-hmm. right?
Of course.
So it was a risk to them, but thankfully they were willing to take it.
So I just want to check I'm understanding you right. So the preparations that you were making are obviously a whole plant product. The GW preparation was also a whole plant product, or was it synthetic?
Oh, no, it was a whole plant product. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it was just a CBD extraction at that point, or were the other the rest of the chemical profile also present?
So in order to get a product approved by the FDA, even for compassionate use, you have to show that impurities are less than 0.15%.
Okay.
So it was a whole plant extract, but they had to show that other components were less than 0.15%.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are other components, but they're all below what the FDA qualifies as a level. Anything above 0.15% is considered an active ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so how did Ben respond to this treatment?
The same.
The same. Okay.
Yeah, the same.
Okay. And again, just trying to get the timeline. When was this that you approached GW?
So let's see. We approached them in late 2013.
Mm-hmm.
The Compassionate Access IND was approved in mid-2014.
Mm-hmm. So Ben was 5 or 6 at this point?
He was 4, 5.
Okay. And what was his quality of life like? Was he able to be at kindergarten or at school?
Yeah. So he always went to a special day class.
Mm-hmm.
He's nonverbal but could move around on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad to think about, actually, because when he was 5, he was still very independent, moving around, and he wasn't having any drop seizures. He only had this one seizure type, which was the generalized tonic-clonic seizure,
mm-hmm.
which is like a grand mal seizure.
Right.
Now he's 10, and he has like 5 different seizure types.
Wow.
And he can't walk independently anymore. And this is the sad thing about the progression of the disease, is it the outcome, if you can't stop the seizures, the outcome is not good.
Right.
And it affects the function of the child.
Mm-hmm. I assume that takes up a fair bit of your time and your attention and energy on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, it does.
I want to kind of jump over to your professional experience, which I guess has been, you know, as we said before, so influenced by your personal story. When did medical cannabis start being part of your career as well as your family life?
Okay, so after I did the clinical research fellowship, I had a decision to make about what I wanted to do with my career.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that I was absolutely infuriated to find out that we knew CBD was an anticonvulsant, but nobody had developed it for 30 years. And I, because of my training, I understand that CBD represents a new class of drugs for seizures, right? Mm. So we have 40 drugs on the market. They all fall within 4 or 5 buckets for mechanism of action. CBD is a completely new one. And so I was infuriated to find out that no one had developed it, largely because of its controlled substance status, right? Because it was Schedule 1, mm-hmm. which means no medical value. So I had a decision to make, and I knew that it was important to me, given our experience with epilepsy and the severity of it, that there are other patients out there living with other diseases besides epilepsy who deserve access to medical quality medical cannabis products now, and they don't have time to wait for clinical development.
Yep.
And it seemed unlikely, and it still seems unlikely now, 5 years later, that any company will develop these products the way GW developed Epidiolex.
Mm-hmm. And so what happened next?
So then I decided to work for Tilray, because at Tilray I knew that they were operating under the philosophy that patients deserve access now.
Right.
In Canada, they could do that. They were founded by good people, and they were doing the right thing. So they were controlling for product quality. So it was an opportunity to get these quality controlled products to patients everywhere, patients who needed them now and not in some undefined period of time when some company was going to be granted marketing authorization for a cannabinoid drug.
Right. And what's your role, or what was your first role at Tilray? Where did you start out?
So initially I started out as the director of clinical research, mm-hmm. and I started their clinical research program. Mm-hmm. Now we have, don't quote me on this, but we have around 8 ongoing clinical trials.
Okay.
In chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, alcohol use disorder, interestingly, essential tremor. Mm-hmm. Can't list them all. So now my job is to do so about a year and a half ago, I moved from clinical research to start the regulatory affairs department and the medical affairs department.
Mm-hmm. So I think something that we all come across at different levels within this industry is stigma. I'm interested to hear about where that kind of has hit you, I guess, both on the personal level and on the professional level.
Well, I have some good stories about the professional level. Mm-hmm. I think personally it hasn't hit much because I live in California.
Right.
And there really isn't a lot of stigma in my world. Even though I'm not a cannabis user, but mm-hmm. I still never felt the stigma in my personal life. Mm. Professionally, in the beginning, I sat through meetings where researchers and doctors would talk about CBD, mind you, mm-hmm. CBD, not THC. We were always dealing with just CBD, and they would joke about getting high, or they would joke about, stoners, and it was belittling and it was offensive because I was talking to them about treating my son's life-threatening condition.
Right.
And they were joking to me about getting high.
Wow. And completely inaccurate and misinformed.
Yep.
I'm happy to hear that on the professional level and the personal level, you've also had good stories. Have you worked with the specific physicians that have been really supportive? It kind of sounds like from the beginning of your story that you were kind of there on your own putting this treatment together.
I was, but for all the negative, stories, I have some really good positive stories too. Mm-hmm. And so I want to give Dr. Oren Davinsky credit because mm-hmm. He's a leading pediatric epileptologist mm-hmm. in the U.S., very reputable at NYU. And I brought him on board early on because I knew that if he lent his name to the project, it would be more likely to be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, and he was happy to, and he was fully involved from the beginning. So I give him a lot of credit for that. Ben's day-to-day epileptologist, Dr. Joe Sullivan mm-hmm. at UCSF, was also very supportive from the beginning. So I give him a lot of credit too.
Sounds like you're really in the right place for this as well.
I was. I was very lucky.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to wrap up asking you what needs to happen next, I suppose, in the larger global sense in order to get these treatments to people who need them now, but also specifically in the area that you're working.
Oh, boy. That's a tough one. Well, let me start by saying that there are irrational, illogical conversations going on from both sides right now. And I think it's doing a disservice to helping us mature as a legitimate, credible industry. So I'll give you two examples. One example is when I sit down with a doctor and I say, why won't you prescribe this for your patient?
Right.
The doctor will put their hands up and say, well, I can't, there's not enough clinical data and I'm not going to do it. And so that's an approach that doesn't take into account the risk-benefit analysis for each individual patient.
Right.
Right. And so I think with doctors, we have to start, and doctors have to start being willing to consider that it's more rational to have a risk-benefit analysis conversation about each patient mm-hmm. than it is to rely on clinical data. Because the truth is, the clinical data is based on statistics.
Right.
And even with that large amount of clinical data, at the end of the day, that doesn't tell you whether your patient will respond or not. You have to try it in your patient.
Yeah.
And then on the other side, I've been really frustrated with the perpetuation of myths by medical cannabis activists who really do a disservice to the industry in general. Because mm-hmm. if you perpetuate myths that aren't evidence-based, then we don't get to a place where we're having rational, evidence-based conversations, right? And so one of those myths that really I want to dispel is this myth of the entourage effect. Mm-hmm. So the entourage effect, that term initially was coined by Dr. Mashulam's postdoc.
Yeah.
And it was coined to reflect the fact that 2-AG, which is an endocannabinoid, binds to multiple receptors in the brain. Now the term is being used to describe the effect of some synergism between multiple cannabinoids or terpenes. And so it's a bunch of little misinformations like that, mm-hmm. that really discredits the entire industry. So
that's really interesting. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. I think so. So back to your question about how do we move this forward? Mm-hmm. We have to start talking on both sides about data. We have to have a rational approach to evaluating the risk benefit for each individual patient. Mm-hmm. We have to acknowledge what the real public health risks are and have that conversation instead of some general fear-based conversation about what legalizing cannabis will do to society. Mm. Right. So I think it requires measured voices coming into the conversation who are interested in solving the problem, not interested in either perpetuating the stigma or boosting their egos.
Right. It's a lot of work to be done.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining me here today, Catherine.
Thanks, Elena.
I'm Michael Schaefer Omerman. This episode was produced by myself and Alana Goldberg, edited and mixed by me. And on behalf of myself and the entire Conigma team, we hope that you're staying safe, healthy, and that the world looks like a slightly better place by the time you're listening to this.